Thank you, Vic. As Holly said, I'm Zach Mannix, and basically I got drawn into Arctic Entries and the community building storytelling event that it is by dating and eventually asking Emily Fehrenbacher to marry me, and she's, And I had the privilege of telling a story in Anchorage at the event, and it really is a fantastic opportunity to just share your little vision of, or your little slice of life with a large group of people. And nothing has influenced me more in my entire life than growing up in Talkeetna, of course, so this just seemed like the next logical move outside of Anchorage to really explore. So, and this venue is fantastic, and I hope you all really enjoy the show. So with that, I'll turn it over to the professional host and hostess, Emily Fehrenbacher and Matt Rafferty. Thank you.
Thanks for the kind words, Zach. I thought you'd be mean. Just kidding.
We're really excited to be in Talkeetna, everybody. Thanks so much for having us here and for coming on out.
So how many people have actually heard of Arctic Entries or heard a story before here? Just raise your hand. Pretty good number.
Yeah, it's a good number.
But still, a fair amount of people probably have no idea what you're getting into tonight, right?
Put those hands up.
All right.
Good. Yeah, we got like 50-50.
You want to give us a little history there, Matt?
So we like to say at Arctic Entries that what we're trying to do is build community one story at a time, right? And this is our fifth season of doing it in Anchorage. And last year was the first time we ever did a road show, and that was up in Healy. And so we thought, where would be another great spot to do it? And we said, God, Talkeetna, you guys are all characters, right? Like, everybody's got a story. And in Anchorage, we usually just have seven people tell stories, but because the stories here are so ripe, we had to have nine. So we have nine stories tonight.
Correct. And so how this is going to work is we've chosen a theme. And so the theme for tonight's show is the end of the road, stories of getting here, getting wild, and staying put. Mm-hmm. So everybody is going to tell a story somewhat related to that theme.
And the stories are, the way our program works, the stories are 7 minutes long. And so they have 7 minutes to tell their story. We keep track of time with a harmonica. And when it hits 5 minutes, Emily will have a clock, I will have
a
harmonica, and together we will let people know there's 5 minutes, that they've gone 5 minutes. At 7 minutes, we blow it a little more vigorously. And that means that it's time to wrap up. And if they don't do it, we ask the audience to charge the stage, knock them to the ground, and drag them off and put them someplace that we can't see them. So we'll give you the cue.
Seriously, though, don't do that. That's really rude. We'll just keep blowing it until they stop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So in that, we're going to...
The other great thing about Arctic Entries is that every show we have a musician, and so we always ask somebody local, usually in Anchorage, but tonight we've asked Murray Nash if he would play a song for us.
So Murray, why don't you kick it off with a song for us?
Thank you.
So we'll be hearing more from Murray in the second half of our show. And we should have mentioned how we're going to do this is we'll have 5 stories, and then we'll have an intermission for drinks and bathroom, and then we'll come back and have another 4 stories and more music, of course. So our first storyteller is Joe Page. And last night when we had rehearsal, Joe came and was a way better story coach than any of us that do this every month in Anchorage. And so his story is just phenomenal. So welcome our first storyteller, Joe Page.
Well, the theme, Into the Wild, would probably frame this story. And people go off into the wilderness for many reasons. And as it turns out, many of our great spiritual leaders have gone off into the wilderness and come back with pretty interesting experiences and understanding of where they've been. Well, Chris Mannix and I went off on an adventure into the Alaska Range to climb Denali, 100 years ago, not quite, but it seemed like a long time ago. And, along about the third night of our journey is, you climb high, carry high, sleep low, carry high, sleep low, and so forth. We were making dinner one night, and we started talking about all these great spiritual leaders that have gone off into the wilderness. Muhammad, he went and lived in a little cave and, talked to God that way. And, Jesus went off into the wilderness and for 40 days and 40 nights. And, Buddha sat next to the river and, learned many things. And, Moses, went up on the mountain. And, Moses came back with 10 commandments. And so, after dinner and, maybe a game of cribbage, Chris and I were just discussing, different ideas about this, and we, realized Moses had 10 commandments, and so we decided to see if we could remember them all. And so, not having Google, we couldn't just look it up, and so we just had to rely on memory. And, Chris, a good Catholic boy, and he was pretty feeble, I have to say. But the fact that I was a preacher's kid didn't really help either. I think collectively, and Chris is here in the audience this evening, and he could probably correct me, but I believe we came up with about 6. So, not steal and lie and, covet thy neighbor's wife and things like that. But there was no way we could come up with all 7 or all 10. Anyway, the rest of our journey along the route up the West Buttress, as we encountered other climbing parties, I would go forth and I'd ask them, do you guys know the 10 Commandments? And so, do unto others as thou shalt do unto to you. No, that's the golden rule. That has nothing to do with the 10 Commandments. I remember specifically encountering a group of dentists that were climbing from, I think they were from Juneau, and, I think they were able to, between the party of 6, come up with maybe 1 additional commandment that Chris and I hadn't really quite realized yet. But, we had not really made very much progress in the whole experience. Anyway, we climbed on and met different groups. And, a couple of the groups, we felt pretty good because they didn't know 1. They'd never even heard of the 10 Commandments. So finally we got up to 17,000 and there was a guided party up there and, we went over and were chatting with them and talked at various length and found out that There was a born-again Christian in the group who had been proselytizing, to the, I think some of the other party members were not so pleased with this experience. And so, we said, okay, this would be a perfect guy to ask, do you know the Ten Commandments? And, the guy took a deep breath and he said, I'm a New Testament guy. So, no, he didn't. So, Chris and I felt pretty good that we'd come up with six. Anyway, we went on and we were fortunate to summit, and we came back down, and on our as we got down, we unfortunately had encountered this another team from Homer that had an accident up there in Denali Pass, and we had agreed to carry out their gear. So we grabbed their gear, and among other things in their gear was a gallon jug of white gas. So we came back down to 14,000, and we were loading up our gear and getting ready to descend down to base camp, and we found this little place where you could leave fuel at 14,000, because it seemed like, if you got up to 14,000 and you ran out of fuel, hadn't calculated right, your climb would be, in jeopardy, serious. Anyway, so we were taking our fuel can over to this little cache that was up there, and here came this group of Italians, and they came over to us and struck up a conversation. There was one guy in their party who could speak English. So after, a few minutes of exchanging route conditions and so forth, I posed the question. I said, do you guys know the Ten Commandments? And, the one guy who could speak English, turned to his buddies, and they had a long conversation. And finally, he turned back to me and he said, is it okay if we sing them? And I said, sure. So, in Italian, in three-part harmony, they, sang the Ten Commandments. At the end of the song, Chris and I looked at each other and went, we didn't know if they knew him or not, but how could you challenge that? And the guy who could speak English finally came forth and he said, that's 10. Anyway, that's the story.
Are you going to list all 10 of them right now?
No, I was going to see if the audience... If you guys know the Ten Commandments, because, I cheated. I went to Google this afternoon, and, so let's see how you guys can do. Okay.
Kill,
got it. Okay. Good. Yep. Got it. Oh, you got a lot left. That's 4. Father and mother. Got it. Good. Good. All right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
I make a motion to change it. This should only be 6 commandments, right? Who needs the extra 4? We're going to have Murray jam out the 10 commandments at the intermission, so sing along in Italian for anyone who's feeling good tonight. So thank you, Joe. That was great. Our next storyteller is a guy. So I've been doing this for several years in Anchorage now, and people keep saying, have you guys ever had Art Mannix come down? I'm like, no, we haven't. Like, you've got to get Art Mannix to come down. So instead, we had to come up here. in order to get our next storyteller to tell a story. So make welcome Art Mannix.
I was in my second semester of my second year as a chemistry major at the University of New Hampshire. I was also on the gymnastics team, and it was a disciplined and it was a challenging life for me. And although I chose it, I wasn't really gratified because I found I was spending all my life indoors. I was spending my entire life in laboratories or in gymnasiums, and I felt like my life was really somewhat myopic. My brother, Chris, at the time was down in Boston, and he was going to Boston College, and he was having kind of a hard time adapting to life in Boston. And when he and a close friend came up with the idea of heading out west to check out what was going on out west, I jumped at the opportunity, and lo and behold, we found ourselves that spring shuttling a used van from New York to the West Coast, and kind of in exchange for loading it up with 4 months worth of food and our backpacks for kind of, I guess you would call it nowadays, a vision quest. So anyway, we managed to have an amazing journey. We hiked from the Columbia River down to Yosemite in California, after which point all of us pretty much decided that the West was for us. Chris decided to stay out west and go to school in Corvallis, Oregon, the University of Oregon, and I decided to head back east to continue my studies and finish up my degree at the University of New Hampshire, after which point I was fully intending on coming out west. But prior to hitchhiking back east, I met this amazingly generous genius inventor, and his name was Bob Gillis. He went by the name of Mateen. And this fellow had invented the dome tent. Now, I guess that doesn't ring too much of a bell, but because dome tents are so ubiquitous nowadays. But prior to 1974, virtually every shelter that hikers and climbers used up to that point were these A-frame type pup tents, which are cramped, they're not very wind resistant, they're heavy. And the dome tent virtually revolutionized the experience of, you know, backcountry travel. So Mateen was amazingly gracious to give me the plans, a set of working drawings for fabricating my own dome tent. So I hitchhiked back east, and I decided just to kind of mix up my head a little bit and to try to make some money before I went back to return to school. I got a job driving a cab in New York, and I cut my hair really short and said, "What not?" I was just out, you know. And then the following spring, I returned to New Hampshire to go back to school. I found a treadle sewing machine in a garage sale, and I sewed up this 15-foot diameter double-walled nylon dome tent. And I decided, wow, if I'm going to live in this tent, I'm going to find the coolest place to live. So I hopped on my 5-speed Humber Sports. And the University of New Hampshire is in coastal New Hampshire, and it's along this system of estuaries and bays, and there are these peninsulas. It's really gorgeous. And so I decided to ride out the most beautiful place I could find and knock on doors and ask people, you know, I'm a thrifty kind of student and I'm responsible, and I'm not a slob, you know, could I set up my tent in your property while I go to school? And every door I knocked on, people kept saying, oh, you should go out the road, you should check out Ed Brown, she's a little bit down the road, she'd be kind of cool, you should check it out. And I just ride bike further and knock on the door, and the next person would say the same thing. Kept riding out this peninsula, it got more and more beautiful. Finally, I'm towards the end of Durham Point. It's all these stone walls and hay fields and shagbark, hickory, and red oak and white oak forests. And I go down, and there's this rambling kind of a cottage kind of thing that this woman actually built. Knocked on the door, and this little spry, white-haired, high-spirited woman answers the door. And she says, I gave her my spiel, and she said, well, let's go for a little bit of a walk. So we go for this walk, and she starts regaling me with these amazing stories of like the 1930s in the Canadian Rockies around Banff, where her father dragged her around living in a teepee, her family in a teepee, while he oil painted in the West. It was like, wow, this woman's amazing. And so eventually she said, well, you know, what do you want to do with your life? And I said, well, I'd really like to try. I changed my degree my from chemistry to zoology because I thought they'd give me outsides more. And so she goes, what do you want to do with your life? And I just said, oh, man, I'd really like to try to get to Alaska and try to climb Mount McKinley. At which point she just stopped, her eyes opened up, and she goes, that's very interesting. My father led expeditions up Mount McKinley in 1906, 1910, and 1912. And she was Evelyn Brown. Her father was Belmore Brown, who wrote one of the most fantastic adventure stories ever written about Alaska. It's called The Conquest of Mount McKinley. And it's kind of the title doesn't really do justice to the book because it's kind of an understanding of Mount McKinley as what Belmore. So anyway, I spent the next 2 years living this amazing existence as a student, 10 miles from school, riding my bike back and forth, and hitchhiking up to the White Mountains in New Hampshire and rock climbing around the Old Man of the Mountain up on Cannon Cliff, Franconia Notch, White Horse Ledge, all these beautiful granite. And there's this old formation called the Old Man of the Mountain. So anyway, these amazing people would come by Evelyn's place too. Bradford Washburn was a dear friend at the Boston Museum of Science. And the fellow who wrote this book, well, I got to study in Evelyn's library, and the library was festooned with all these amazing oil paintings that Belmore had done. This is one of the oil paintings that was in the library too. And it was all these oil paintings of Alaska. There was a rock from Brown Tower, which was named after Belmore Brown. Belmore was one of the movers and shakers in the founding of Mount McKinley National Park. And so Robert Bates, who was the author of this book, who was also the chairman of the American Alpine Club, he was the director of the Peace Corps in Nepal, he would come by and have tea with me in my dome. And he'd look at the dome and he goes, Belmore would love this. So finally, after a couple of years, I finally got my degree to graduate. And I didn't even friggin' wait to go to, I didn't, graduation, forget that, man. I just packed my pack. You know, I stuffed it and I gave Evelyn a big, big hug. And she goes, you go to Alaska, Arthur, just go for it, you know. And I stuck out my thumb, and I hitchhiked here to Talkeetna. And I remember at the time when I was leaving New Hampshire, I wasn't leaving New Hampshire because I didn't love it. I love New Hampshire. I love the granite, the hardwood forests, the ancient mountains. And I remember saying to myself when I left that place, I just, you know, I'm going to come back here. I'm going to be an old man here in New Hampshire because I just love New England so much. But about 15 years ago, I saw in the news that the Old Man of the Mountain, which was an emblematic big granitic formation that had been up on the top of Cannon Cliff for hundreds of thousands of years, collapsed in a catastrophic landslide. And it was just around the kind of same time, coincidentally in my life, that I realized that I'm not going to go back east and be an old man back east. I'm going to stay out. I'm going to be an old man right here.
So our next storytellers came highly recommended from Don Lee. So we said we've got to have them. And they're going to tell a story together. And so this is a new experience for us at Arctic Entries. So please welcome Roger Anderson and Heather Calera.
Well, thank you for inviting us here tonight.
Thank you.
We're going to kind of tag team this a little bit because at my age, 1 year or 10 years all kind of runs together, and it's all yesterday. So she can keep me up to date on people's names and on time frame. This is our story of coming up here. We started out several years ago. We flew up here in a small aluminum tin can, spent 65 hours together doing that, coming back. We came up in August, didn't realize it was your rainy time. We never saw the mountain. It rained every day. The only animal we saw was a huge black hairy dog with a brown face that I found out later was a bear on the tarmac at the airport. So we absolutely loved it up here after looking around to see where we wanted to end up at. And it took us about 3 years to go back and finalize everything. I wish we would have hitchhiked up here as that. It would have been much, much nicer. But we had my mother to take care of, who was out early, and we were going to bring her up here, and our two Great Danes. And to try and get all of that up here, we decided, well, we'd get a motorhome, and we'd do that deal of crossing the United States and getting to see everything. So to get everything together, I ended up flying up here, looking at a house we had here, flew to Houston, picked up a motorhome that was down there, flew back and picked it up, drove back in a huge thunderstorm, made it to St. Louis, decided I wasn't about to drive this 36-foot motorhome that I just picked up in a thunderstorm through St. Louis, and spent the night there. That cut us quite a bit on time because we still had this huge high cube cargo container that you guys call Connex containers to load yet. And we had to be out of our property the following week. So at the same time, my mother decides that she wants to sell her house rather than just come along for a trip and sell it later. So we had her stuff to deal with as well. So we're packing the motorhome, packing the cargo container. The cargo container had four different companies that had to go through to get here. So I didn't want to put anything that was really valuable into the cargo container. So that all got packed into the motorhome. And it makes you realize what's really important when you start packing all this stuff and all the trappings you have through life. You really don't need much of this. We left in a thunderstorm coming to take our tour of southern United States. And we got through part of Oklahoma and wandered our way across. We were going to see some friends outside of Colorado Springs, got stuck in one of your late snowstorms. And the windshield wiper blew off of the driver's side. So thinking that wouldn't be too bad, we spent the next day with friends of mine. We were only going to stay there for the night, but we ended up spending 3 days trying to find a windshield wiper arm. Finally had that ordered overnight, not realizing, because you lose track of what day it is, that it's Friday and overnight means Monday. So we finally decided, okay, we're going to leave on the Sunday. While we were in Colorado Springs, we went and looked at gold mines and trapped around. They lived outside of Pikes Peak, so we got to go take a look up through there, took my mother up around through there, had an absolutely great time. We left on the Sunday, everybody was in good spirits, and we drove all day, got to Rawlins, Wyoming, and they have a really nice park outside of Rawlins that, what is that, Seminole or something
Seminole.
Like that?
Yeah.
Seminole, it's about 40 miles outside of Rawlins. And early enough in the year that there was absolutely nobody there except these huge piles of horse crap and and nothing else. We figured we'd find that out eventually. But we were the only people there. And we had a nice meal and spent the night there. Unfortunately, about midnight, my mom was up walking, knocking around in the motorhome and was not feeling well. And she ended up passing away. Had a major heart attack. We couldn't get into Rawlins in time. The coroner had told us that it wouldn't have mattered if we were parking in the parking lot in next to the hospital. It was that major. But she went very quickly, and it was doing something that she wanted to do, and she wanted to come up here. So that we take advantage of that. It took us 3 days to take care of her there. She wanted to be cremated, so we took care of that and took her with us, decided that we were going to cut our touring a bit short and just head straight up here. So we had a good trip. The night before we left, they had a rainstorm come through, and Rawlins is kind of deserty, so it's kind of neat having, you can see the rainstorms coming in, and this huge rainbow came across where we were staying at. And Heather and I both looked at it and we thought, well, okay, this is it. Of all the trials and tribulations of getting everything pulled together, everything's going to go smooth now. So we took off, and we traveled how many miles that day?
Quite a few. We made it into about Big Timber, Montana.
Yeah, we were outside of Big Timber. We stopped up at a rest area, checked everything over, and it was fine. And we got just about 4 miles where we were going to stay from the night, and the motorhome starts slowing down. And I thought, what the expletive? and Heather says, we've got smoke coming out the back. So we were towing my pickup truck behind it as well, which my friend had given me a lock for, which I'd left the keys in the ignition of the motorhome when I jumped out with the fire extinguishers. Realized that that was a total waste of time. And basically, our motorhome burned to the ground. We spent 2.5 weeks, but the good part is we had a gentleman who saw the motorhome explode. He stopped, helped corral Heather running down the highway, and the dogs as well, but we tried to get a few things out of there. He stayed with us the entire time while the fire department got there, the sheriff, the state police. He
made
drove
sure we
us.
Weren't operating a meth lab.
Yeah. He drove us a mile or an hour into Bozeman, made sure we had a hotel where we could take two Great Danes and our smoky stuff that we had left into, and would not take a nickel to help clean his truck out. This was not an extended cab, not a crew cab, so I mean it was pretty packed going in there. Would not take a nickel. The only thing he said to me was to pass this on to someone else sometime. And we finally made it up here. We absolutely love it up here, and this is where we intend to make our home for the rest of our lives. But that's our story on getting here. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that. Another one of those ho-hum, you know, find your way to Alaska stories. Very nice. Thank you. So our next storyteller today, we had a storytelling workshop here in Talkeetna today, right here in this very room, and a number of people showed up. And our next storyteller actually showed up because he thought that the show was taking place at 2 p.m. and he wanted to know where to pay his, you know, $8 or $10 to come and enjoy the show. And we had to explain, no, this is actually just a workshop. We're going to talk about storytelling, but he's like, well, I think we'll just watch and maybe we, you know, I probably won't tell a story or anything. So then halfway through, our next storyteller, Steve Lufkin, tells a story. And everyone loved it. And then at the end, we're like, you know, we have a few more spots if anyone wants to tell a story. So our next storyteller, Steve Lufkin, decided to stay here, get a room in Talkeetna tonight, come back to the stage, and tell you guys a story. So Steve Lufkin, come on up.
Thank you very much. I wasn't prepared to tell the story, as you heard, and my wife, Donna, and I came up here today. And so I know it's not so much of a coming to Alaska story that I'm going to tell you as it is a going home story to Pensacola, Florida, where my wife is from. A few years back, we went to Pensacola, Florida. Her family is there, and we were visiting. And she, over the years, had kept in contact. Every once in a while, she'd hear from a guy that she knew in high school. And I think they might have dated a little bit. And so his name was Buzzy, and so she let Buzzy know that, oh, we're in town. And so he said, wow, he was excited. And I just bought a new, for me, 28-foot sailboat, and I'm an accomplished sailor. And how about you and Steve come out, and Cheryl and I are out there, and we'll enjoy ourselves on the boat tonight. I would rather be out in the daytime, but okay, we'll come out there. So Donna and I that evening go out to the marina and heading out there, walking on the gangplank towards some boats, and there's a number of them. And we see this guy, and he's like this, and we're approaching. Oh, okay, that must be Buzzy. I had never met him. Buzzy turns out to be this real short guy. And he's holding this great big orange juice. So, come on aboard. So, okay, it must be a screwdriver. it's a little bit unsure now. And so we get on board, and he's telling us about, you know, this boat and how he's got all this sailing experience and meet Cheryl, and she's accomplished too. And we're just going to go out, and we're going to go out into the bay a little bit and chug around, and it's a nice evening here in Pensacola Bay. And then after a while we'll go and pull into one of the slips in front of this restaurant, and we can get some drinks or something, maybe eat some dinner. So that sounds good. Okay, it's a nice night, warm Florida. Well, we start out of the slip and we're heading into this little bayou and then following the waterway, and there's the restaurant, and it's full. There's no place to park the ship, our sailboat, and we got the motor going. So he said, okay, well, let's just head on out into the bay. So he cranks the engine up, and then and the whole boat is starting to vibrate, and oh my gosh, what is that? Well, it turns out he hadn't actually had this boat out on the water before. And it was a vibrating propeller, because the propeller was out of round, apparently. So, oh man, well, now what? But he wasn't going to be done with this. This was going to be a lot of fun. He was an accomplished sailor. So, well, we get out there, and we can't run too fast because of the vibration. So he says, well, I'll just put up the sails. So, okay, this will be good. So he raises the mainsail, and it was just enough of a breeze, and it was a beautiful night, and there was a full moon, and the stars were out, and this is pretty good. We're starting to cruise along. Well, let's go a little faster. Let's put up the jib. So now we got two sails out. It's about a 28-foot sailboat with a cabin below, and so we're cruising along, and we're starting to get comfortable. And Buzzy, where are we heading? Well, we're going to head out there to the shipping lines. What? Well, how do you know? Well, you can see those lights. Those are the buoys that mark the shipping channel. So, okay. So we're heading out there, and it's good ways out there, you know, maybe several miles, 5, 6, 7 miles. And so we're cruising along, and we can see because we've got the moonlight and getting comfortable, talking, getting to know each other. Donna and Buzzy are catching up, and wasn't quite sure about that, but but Buzzy would, you know, he was doing pretty good running the boat, and his friend Cheryl was going to bound down below every once in a while and coming back up with some more screwdrivers, which I wasn't quite paying attention to. But I said, Buzzy, I'm only seeing there's a light missing out there in the passageway. Because when you're going in towards the shipping lane, you know, you have the buoys on the left will be green, the ones on the right will be red, and each one will have a light, and that way the intercoastal waterway is marked. There was a light missing. So I mentioned that, and he said, oh, don't worry about it. If it's not there, it's not there. So, okay, we're cruising along, and I'm getting nervous, he's relaxed. We were in the back, and I walk up to the front of the boat, and oh my God, we're going to hit the thing, we hit a buoy. And he says, nah, and then Donna says, she could hear the panic in my voice, and she says, yes, we are. So fortunately, Buzzy jumps up from his relaxed stupor, pulls down the mainsail, and boom, it was an emergency stop just before we hit the buoy that had the red light out. And now we're dead in the water, and we're sitting there. So we had to turn back on the engine, and we start the vibrating, and it's too far out to vibrate all the way back. So he puts the puts the sail back up, and we're heading in, and looking pretty good. I was starting to think, okay, we're heading back. What a night. Well, we get towards the shore, and we're coming in. We're heading back to the little channel that goes into the bayou that takes us back to the slip, and he needs to put the sails back down. And so he says to Cheryl, again, who is an accomplished sailor, you take the engine and bring us in. And Donna, noticing the depth finder, 7 feet, 6 feet, 5 feet. and now we got the engine going, we're vibrating again. And Cheryl panics, and she does one of these, and then we start to do circles to avoid hitting anything in the shallow water. And Buzzy finally gets the sails up, put them packed away, comes over and takes over the engine, and fortunately he was able to bring us back safely to the slip back in the marina. And with all the screwdrivers, and then I thought, that's why they call him Buzzy.
All right. Thanks for sticking around to tell that story to the crew. All right. All right, we got one more story before intermission, and I'm sure it is a woman that a lot of people know very well, and it's a story that we heard last night and thought was hilarious. So please welcome my future mother-in-law, Barb Mannix.
So 30-some-odd years ago, there wasn't a lot of employment opportunity in Talkeetna, and so those of us that were young people then had to leave to work in the summer and fall, kind of, and then we came back for the winter, so it was kind of the opposite of what happens now. So my boyfriend at the time, his father had a place outside of San Diego that he wanted to remodel, so we went down with a friend of ours who was also a carpenter to be the first phase of the demolition for getting ready for this remodeling. So this house was located down Long Dirt Road, and then there was a locked gate, and then a series of switchbacks that went down to the house. Anyway, so this house was incredibly remote for outside of San Diego. There were no other neighbors, no other houses in sight. I mean, it was very, very remote. It didn't take too long after we started exploring the area that we realized that we were also surrounded by a major marijuana growing operation. So we figured, well, you know, we're just going to keep our heads down. This isn't our scene. You know, we're just not going to make any waves. You know, hopefully it'll all just go away. Well, that all worked for a little while until one day we looked out the window and there were these guys up at the top of the hill in suits and 9 black blazers coming down the switchbacks. Well, it didn't take too long for us to make the decision that we didn't really want to be there when these guys got there. So we jumped out a window and booked it down into the oak scrub. So after about 2 hours, the guys started getting antsy and decided they wanted to go up and check it out. So needless to say, it wasn't very long before they were apprehended. And so I laid under an oak tree in a dry creek bed for 6 hours. And rather than completely freak out about what might be happening, I had kind of a zen day. And I just kind of looked at little spider webs and little leaves and tried to stay focused on really nice things. And unbeknownst to me, up above, the narcs were getting ready to take these guys in when the growers showed up at the top of the hill and were watching the whole process through their binoculars, and another black blazer came up behind them, and their trunk was full of irrigation supplies and other growing paraphernalia. So the tables turned, and the guys came and got me after 6 hours, told me the tale, and I flew out the next day. I was like, I'm out of here. So the cops had asked kind of enthusiastically that we stick around. And the guys flew out right after I did. So even though we got back to Talkeetna, we were still a little paranoid. And as it turned out, they never got in touch with us. But most people that come to Alaska that are getting away from something generally go farther. And that's exactly what we decided to do. So we flew out to the Talkeetna Mountains and decided to hang out there for a while. So we flew into this lake that had a small cabin. And the next day, the lake froze up, so we knew nobody was coming in for a while. So when I say small, this cabin was small. It was like maybe 7 by 10. It had like 3 logs up, and then the roof was like this. So there was room just in the end for a door. And then you walked in, it was a dirt floor. There was a gas tank, a wood stove, and a bed that was like under the roof like this. So the person sleeping on the inside of the bed had a purlin that was about 4 inches above your nose. So there was not much snow. This was in October, and so traveling was really amazing. The snow was really condensed down. You could go anywhere. And that was great for us, but it was also great for lots of four-legged creatures. So it wasn't long after we got there that this cabin started to look like a hub of a wheel, and coming from 360 degrees were all these little trails of tiny, tiny little footprints, all converging. So once a week, I would stay home and get the wood stove really cranked up, melt a bunch of snow, wash me, my hair, laundry, and while all my clothes were drying, I would bake bread and kill shrews. So I would be in my boots because it was so hot in the cabin to bake the bread. So I would sit on the end of the bed, and I'd put a morsel of food down on the floor, and when the first shrew came, I would take a stretching board and bonk the first shrew. And then the second shrew would come to eat the first shrew, and I'd bonk the second shrew. Pretty soon I'd have like this pyramid of shrews. And my record was 13 shrews in the time that it took to do a bed-breaking shift. So anyway, that was daytime. Nighttime was a whole different story. I would lay on my left side and put my fingers in my ears with my headlamp on one of the main portals of entry, and Mark would balance a .22 handgun on my hip. And when the redback voles would start to come in, he would blow them away, and we'd put like these little bloody carcasses, usually three or four of them, on the floor to keep the shrews down. Well, that worked for a while until one night we were only able to shoot one vole, and I don't know if we decimated the population or if the word got out that, you know, the mousy vortex was a dangerous place to come to. So anyway, we put the bloody little carcass down, and now I need to point out that I was sleeping on the inside of the bed. And in the middle of the night, a shrew ran over my face. So I sat up, as you can imagine, with a fair amount of velocity and smashed my face right into that log purlin. So I determined that my nose nor my face were broken, but I had a major meltdown. And the next day I found a spruce tree with a big well, and I put spruce boughs under it, and that became my new bedroom. And that first night when I settled in, I realized that I was seeking solace under yet another tree and in a very, very different environment, however. So it wasn't too long after that it snowed a great big dump and it buried the cabin and it sealed it all off, and I was able to move back in and we no longer lived in the mousy vortex. Thank you.
I feel like she should get another 7 minutes so we can find out what happened next. Thanks, Barb. That's great.
All right. So I think we're going to take, what, a 10-minute intermission? Is that good? 10 minutes?
It's 8:30 right now, so like 8:40.
Yeah, 8:40. And then we've got four more great stories and some more music.
Great. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, thanks.